said that only the jiva has true free will, but does it exist as free will at that stage or level?
At that level, it is creative will, creative action. The thing that produced all this world, created all this world, isn't that marvelous? Only that has the power, to use a very common word, though it's probably at that level again, it's not power. Only that has the power to do, to undo, not to do. Kartum, akartum, anyatha kartum. All the rest is, we are only struggling. And we go on imagining that I can do this, I can do that. And we try all sorts of gimmicks, like, you know, you enter into deep meditation and by will it and something happened. If it did happen, then it means you're not here. There is a beautiful expression in Sanskrit called kakataliya. A crow flew and sat on a coconut palm tree and the fruit fell down. Did the crow dislodge the fruit? It's difficult for a chopper to free it from the tree. And yet this little silly little crow sat on it and dislodged the fruit, which meant there is an accidental coincidence. So I pray for something, I will something, and that's, you know, that's this sort of thing. And then occasionally something that you prayed for, something that you willed happened. It is mere coincidence. It so happened that at that time your prayer or your will synchronized or coincided with what was coming from up. That is precisely what most of these devotees and so on, they all say. The Bible says so too. What is it? Not even a sparrow will can fall but by the will of the Father. Exactly the same thing. Why do I pray? Why should I not pray? Keep praying. Because if you believe that the human person can somehow force this cosmic consciousness into throwing up a few of these wills to suit my convenience, then the possibilities are horribly limitless. And to illustrate this, there are some funny stories in Indian legends. Someone, he's called a demon because he's called a demon. He performed austerities, tapas, which means standing on his toe, one arm raised up, repeating a mantra. How long? 10,000 years. Okay, all this is legend. The sting comes later. Therefore, it is called interesting. The story is interesting because this thing is last. It comes later. And it was a prayer addressed to Shiva, Lord Shiva. And it is said that Shiva is easily bribed, pleased. And after 10,000 years, Shiva appeared in front of him and he said, I am terribly pleased with your devotion. Well, I grant any boon you choose. Ask. And he asked a boon. He chose a boon. I want this single boon that if I place my hands on someone's head, he must be burnt to ashes. Okay, it's given already. The boon had been granted. Right. He said, come closer, I want to try it on you first. And this god started running. Shiva started running. This story occurs in a scripture which glorifies Vishnu or Krishna. So Shiva started running. And in the meantime, Vishnu had sized up the situation. He knew what had happened. So Shiva was running and this demon was pursuing him. Vishnu intercepted and assuming the form of a little boy, he dug up a small hole in the earth and was planting a tree upside down. The roots above and the branches below. And this demon was proudly walking, chasing the Shiva. He happened to notice this and says, "What a silly boy. Don't you know how to plant a tree?" "I'm not as foolish as you are. You trusted that Shiva. You know that I got this bone from Shiva and you seem to know everything." "Yeah, hi." "He bluffed you. He bluffed you." "How do you know that he bluffed me?" "Hey, if you don't believe, put your hand on your head." And this exchange was so hypnotizingly fast that he said yes. He got himself burnt. So, you see, if you and I, anyone, however saintly, however holy, glory you are, if you have the power to influence these cosmic forces, that's what's called a demon. A demon is not somebody who, you know, with 24 teeth and 4 noses. A demon is one who meddles with the cosmic forces. That's not given to man. And even you may call it karma yoga, you may call it bhakti yoga, you may call it what you like. It is only when this, the false me, the non-existent me, is realized to be non-existent, which is self-surrender or self-sacrifice, then you are considered a saint who is able to do some marvelous things. Which means it is not you that does it. I've heard it from the lips of Swami Shivananda a million times. People would come and say, "Oh, you blessed me and I got what I wanted." And he would say, "Not me. God does it." There's no me at all here. It is God's own power that does it. If your life has been transformed by going to Him, it was God who did it. I have never even heard him say that God made me his instrument to do this. Mm-mm. It's God who does it. The me does not exist even as an instrument. We who are the spectators, we see that she goes to Swami Shivananda and he sort of blesses her or gives her a mantra, mala, something like that. And she is transformed. We, the spectators, attribute this power to him. And if I am his disciple and I know his attitude, that it's not his egoistic Shivananda who does it, then I may rationalize the whole thing that saying that he is such a pure person that God works through him. Even that is not 100% right. He is not there at all. It's God that does it. That's a saintly person. The me must completely dissolve and that must act. And the action of that cosmic consciousness which is in which omnipotence is inherent is creative action. You were saying something, Mani?
Yeah, I was going to ask you for an example of charity, real charity.
Mm-hmm.
That Something the same as...
Real charity, yes. Real charity, again, one must see this done. I don't think it's possible to verbalize it, intellectualize it. There is a formula in some of the Indian scriptures, and this is usually repeated at the end of the ceremonial worship, puja. Tvadiyam vastu govinda tibhyameva samarpaye. I pick flowers from the garden, fruits from the trees, and put them on the altar and offer them to you. What a silly man I am. They were yours before, already you created them. You created them, I give it to you, Lord. Tvadiyam vastu govinda, these already belong to you. You created them and I am offering them to you. Can this attitude be inculcated in us? That is true charity. With Swami Shivananda, this is almost a routine thing. When he gave something, instead of waiting, or even instead of beaming, look what I can, what I'm giving you. He was very humble and grateful if you received it. Again, the same spirit. That's yours already. You are the Lord. It is that omnipresence, one spark of that omnipresence, one spiral of that cosmic consciousness is in front of me. And this belongs to him, not to the me. So it belongs to the other person, and it belongs to the omnipresence, and the omnipresence at that point needs it, it's given. There is no me at all there. That is wonderful charity. It's only when I realize, yes? It is only when I realize that this is not mine. The charity is true, real charity. When I see that this is mine, then that charity is something else. That charity is an ego trip.
Slightly in connection with this distinction that is made between wealth that is acquired without effort and wealth that is acquired with... I can't see how somebody using wealth which is acquired without effort is... It's sanctioning exploitation, because all wealth, like material wealth, is acquired only through exploitation.
No, but that's why I went to some length explaining it. I am born the son of a millionaire.
Yeah, but being born the son of a millionaire,
yes,
doesn't give that person the right...
to spend it?
Yeah.
Why not?
Because it doesn't belong to him.
It does to me. Yeah, legally it is mine now. Legally it is mine now.
Yeah, but morally... it's just as bad for you to spend money that was accumulated by somebody else's exploitation.
Okay, it's mine now.
As by your own exploitation.
It's mine. Why shouldn't I give it in charity?
You're obliged to give it away.
Pardon? I've got to give it away to somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just by spending it, you're giving
it away. Yes, spend it.
No.
Good. No, no objection at all.
If you're spending it in a barter system, then I give you this and you give me that.
No, that's why I nearly objected to that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Then I've still got it if I
spend it. Correct.
You're obliged to give it.
So,
can you
look at that, can I look at that million and realize that it does not belong to me? Wait. Is that right? That's the first step.
Yeah.
I look at it, it doesn't belong to me at all.
Yeah.
To whom does it belong? I don't know. And then comes a man, there's some need. It belongs to him, do it him. That's all. It's quite simple. Huh? Someone comes along and you merely as like a camera, you see that there is a need, push it, pass it on.
You mentioned in connection with that that you decide what you really need and the rest you give away in charity. Now, how do you decide what you really need?
That, a million questions could be asked of that tenor in the whole of the morning's discussion. And they are not satisfactorily answered at all. One must develop the sensitivity. Because, please remember that we are talking from here above. The me is still kept intact. The illusion is still kept intact. I am I, you are you. And there, born of this division, I and you, there are a few hundred more divisions born. Good and evil, right and wrong. The famous definition, what is good, what is right, to do the greatest good to the greatest number of people in the greatest manner. How do I know what is good? And this again is given as a fundamental principle of dharma in India. Paropakara punyaya papaya parapidanam. To do good, to do help others, to do good to others is good. To harm others is evil. What is good? What is not good? A million questions arise from that. And none of them can be really satisfactorily answered. And so, one must again approach it from within. It depends entirely upon your own sensitivity.
The millionaire might feel he needs an estate, whereas a simple person might just feel they need a room.
That's his karma. That's it. One that depends entirely upon that person's sensitivity.
Going back to something that comes out of the earlier question, can karma be transmitted through a group of people as a sort of the karma of a nation or
yeah,
the karma of
the
sins of the father, that kind of thing?
They have suggested such possibilities. What is called anicca prarabdha, parecha prarabdha. Parecha prarabdha is a karma which is not really mine, but into which I was forced, which is forced upon me. Like for instance, I live in a country whose government starts a fight, and I get involved in it, and I am maimed and I am butchered. Am I also involved in it? They say no, but I am not. That's the orthodox doctrine, that it is possible. It is possible for one to be involved in a group action. In modern political terms, you are responsible for the sins of your government, since you are a democracy, and you also vote for them, and you pay taxes, and then you first put them in power by voting, and then you pay taxes to help them do all these dirty jobs, and you do not protest, and thereby acquiescing into whatever crimes they commit. So in a way, this can also be explained satisfactorily, but it is not quite satisfactory. It comes not from belief. I don't know if we discussed this before you came or after. Belief is not a real thing. It's nebulous. It's not real. It comes from faith, in my case. I'm here in spite of the fact that I was involved in any number of incidents where others who belong to the same group and the same, you know, same community, were victimized and killed. Nothing happened to me. I was in the thick of Hindu-Muslim riots. I have no hatred or enmity towards the Muslims. I was not touched. And even most mysteriously, miraculously saved. Miraculously is the word, saved. And I've also been on a hike in the Himalayas, 300-400 miles. In the party, other people were affected in so many ways. Nothing happened to me. So I have a feeling that it's not altogether possible for one to be subjected to retribution, to use that lovely word, which you personally do not deserve. But again, is it possible for collective punishment to be meted out? It's possible. But I have a rather funny way of deciding it. If about 100 people are fated, we'll use common words, destined to die a violent death, all of them are lured to the same Boeing 747. All of them buy the same the ticket in the same airline. Put them all together and blow them. That is nature's economic way of achieving her object. It's not that I am in it because, let me give you a very real and what to me at that time was the clearest proof of what I'm talking about. Not even the other incidents I spoke to you about. This was, I think, way back in 1957-58. It had rained heavily in the Himalayas, and there had been a landslide, very massive landslide, and a valley had been suddenly blocked. A huge dam, natural dam, had been erected. The valley was building up water. It became an instant reservoir. The villagers around the place, they looked at this, they marveled. Fantastic, it would cost them a couple of million dollars to put that up. There it is. Naturally, they were elated and they thought it was some kind of divine dispensation. God's grace, God's mercy, look at this. And some of them came to the ashram and asked a few of us to go and see this marvel. They had nearly decided that God was there in that lake, artificial reservoir. Would you come and have satsang on the bank of this? And some of us decided to go in a truck which was used to cart wood, timber. The truck was owned by a timber processing company in town. And right, the day we went, two or three swamis plus the driver and somebody else, a villager. You wouldn't believe it if I described the road conditions to you in those days, in the mountain road. On some stretches, there was just enough room for the two wheels to roll. On this side, sheer mountain, on that side, sheer drop. How they drive on those roads, only they know, or God knows. Especially at one place, my heart stopped a little bit. Somebody had stuck a sign, danger. The whole road was danger. There was danger in that particular piece of road. And I said, what is danger? We are all sitting in front, there is only one row of seats. And I saw, I couldn't breathe. there is a hump. Hmm? You drive along, you're climbing up, and there is a descent on the other side. Just on the top there, there has been a landslide, and part of the road had been knocked down. A few rocks had fallen, the part of the road had gone. I looked there, not one single inch extra. Not a single inch extra. One little twig, you are gone, finished. And such is human mind. When we passed over that. I got the fright of my life. We drove past that. We went to that place, had a satsang, etc., at the picnic. We were supposed to leave at about 5 o'clock before it got dark. When we came to the truck, we found one wheel flat. One tire was flat. Bad omen, yeah? If you are superstitious, you had it. That. But then, the driver apologized and fixed it in about 20-25 minutes. Then we took off. It had already started getting dark. And then, on the way, he missed his road. He went somewhere else. Went up a hill. Then he realized this mistake. You cannot turn around. You cannot pull in. There is nothing. So, he reversed down that same road. Driving forward is bad enough. Right. He reversed. Found the other road again, other fork, and took the right side and drove along. Again I saw the danger. I nearly wanted to say, will you stop? All of us will get down. And I said, my God, the driver is a family man. We are all Swamis. If we are dead, who cares? And for a moment there was a feeling, I am not going to die, and therefore this truck will go over. And it went over. That incident was over. About 10 days later, the same truck. Now, this time the Swamis were not there. But an assortment of the incredible type. The driver, the owner's son, a forest officer, and somebody else, one other person in the front seat. And two workers, laborers, perched on top. Two laborers perched on top. There are only about four people in the front seat. And I believe this, the truck was proceeding up to that spot, same spot again. And a poor villager was walking along this road, and he belonged to the same village. And as the truck came near him, he looked at the driver, and the driver felt compassion, whatever you wish to call it. Stopped the truck, picked him up, put him also there. Right at this spot, the truck slipped into the valley. Finished. But what was most miraculous in this, those two laborers were saved. They belonged to the truck. They are part of the crew. They came running and they had almost lost their mind looking at this. They came running towards the ashram. And they said, it's fallen down. And then they took some police, etc., and went to investigate. Can you see the lesson here? These two boys, men, belonged to the truck. But something saved them. They say, we don't even know. The truck was proceeding, and suddenly we saw that we were standing on the road and the truck was there. Not a scratch. Right? What happened to that poor villager who was merely hitchhiking? He was so innocent, poor fellow. Huh? If only the driver hadn't taken pity on him and given him a lift, he would have gone an hour later, safely home. So, that which your logic says belongs to the group is saved, and that which your logic says has nothing to do with the group is taken on. That's karma. So I have a sort of very firm, not only faith, almost conviction, that if I do not deserve it, either the good or the non-good, if I do not deserve it, it's not given to me. If I am in this group and you are celebrating Sarah's birthday and there's some lovely chocolate cake and that sort of thing, and I am not destined for to partake it, just that evening I have some stomach trouble and I have to be excused. Nothing is given to you which you do not deserve. That is why in some scriptures like the Ramayana, it is not called fate, it is not called destiny, it is not called not even called karma. But another word is used which is very interesting, kritanta. Anta means end, Vedanta. Anta means end, krita means action. What you call